This is the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, it's estimated that over 1 million New Jerseyans hold $44 billion worth of student loan debt. Two new laws will attempt to protect students who need to borrow money for higher education. We'll get details. Also, the Classic Car Trust in Liechtenstein has named Fred Simeone the world's most relevant collector of classic cars. His stellar collection is located not far from Philly International Airport. We'll catch up to Fred in just a bit. But to begin, the Philadelphia Parking Authority is once again in the spotlight. And what's being revealed isn't pretty. Shades of nepotism at the very top. This is the PPA is trying to make progress following a damaging audit a couple of years ago, which says the authority likely shortchanged Philadelphia's public schools by nearly $78 million in funding. The latest headlines involve PPA board chairman Joseph Ashdale on the job for 18 years. According to the Philadelphia Inquirer, a fair number of Ashdale's extended family have found work at the authority during his tenure, at least one of whom enjoyed $42,000 in tuition reimbursements for higher education. Inquirer columnist Mike Newell wrote recently that Joe's gotta go, and Mike joins us now to talk more about this. Mike Newell, welcome back to Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
So, Mike, the headline on your Wednesday column last week reads, "I wish I was an Ashdale relative." And you write, tongue firmly in cheek, we gather, that you've been spitting into a tube for one of those DNA testing services to see if you are in any way related to Joseph Ashdale because you are looking for a cushy job. Of course, tongue in cheek. But relatives of Ashdale's do seem to do pretty well when it comes to employment at the PPA.
Yes, as my colleague Andrew Seidman reported, 10 of his relatives have gotten work there in his 18 years as chairman. Some of them smaller jobs, low-paying jobs, internships, and some big tuition jobs, like the big high-paying jobs, including school tuition, like his niece that you just mentioned. So yeah, my tongue was firmly in cheek, and it would be funny if this wasn't so distressing, if it wasn't just another chapter in the unmitigated gall of Joe Ashdale and the PPA's and his reign of this of the Philadelphia Parking Authority.
An editorial in the Inquirer describes PPA as a bipartisan patronage mill where politicos can place family, friends, and supporters. How did it get to be this bad?
Well, you know, my first introduction to the PPA was in 2015 when I reported on the Vince Fennedy, the executive director, who at the time we learned had been credibly accused of sexually harassing two women, two employees. Since then, and at that time, you know, the board knew about it and they were trying to protect him and cover it up. Since then, it really is – it's hard to keep up with the reporting that's come out of the paper on the agency. It's kind of like a grab bag of greed and corruption, everything from overtime and workers' comp and health care and no-bid contract to this now. And the fact that Ashdale is, you know, parking authority official number two in a federal corruption indictment. So I think there's been a long history that's been documented about how it's come to that. What's new is how kind of nakedly how much we've put it out into the public now. And just the fact that I think Ashdale, you know, he doesn't answer our calls. He doesn't feel like he needs to answer to anyone. The only time I ever got him on the phone was when he mistakenly picked up and then kind of just breathed into the phone for about a minute and hung up. So that was weird. But this guy and this board, I don't think they feel emboldened to continue to do this. And it's just – it's a disgrace.
Well, let's talk about auditing the PPA. I mean, the agency has been audited infrequently at best. I think in 2016, City Council couldn't agree to request an audit. We'll get into that in a minute. I think that has that has to do with something you mentioned earlier. But how tough is it to get an audit done of an agency like the Philadelphia Parking Authority?
Well, I think to turn it into like a cottage industry. It seems to have – you know, we got an audit saying that there's $78 million shortchange in the school district. You know, they're paying for you know, if you got an Ashdale.
That was done
at
the state level, by the way. That wasn't the city. That was state Auditor General Dean DePasquale had to step in to get the audit done.
So you can get – right now you can You can go if you're in Ashdale, and you could file a job application without even a specific job for a non-posted job and get a college education. And they're shortchanging our school kids, who are getting shortchanged by the state every which way possible, $78 million.
Okay? So, Mike, just pause for 1 second and tell us a little bit about the relationship between PPA and the school district. PPA is supposed to support the school
district. There's supposed to be a major funding source for the school district.
So over a period of 5 years, the audit found that the
$78 million. And you go talk to people, the financial people at the school district, and they say, hey, we get what's left behind. And what's left behind after everyone's got their hand in the pockets is pretty scary. So we have that audit. Then we have the audit that says that we got secretive hiring policies, which Andrew's reporting just bears out. We got him saying, hey, we got a lax oversight that allows a guy like Fennerty, alleged to have sexually harassed two employees, for him to keep in power and to gain the authority for a long time after those allegations have been made. So, and then we got those audits, and then we got him, all this reporting showing all this, really troubling behavior, and the city says, we're going to do an audit. And what does Ashdale do? You think, now I cover Philadelphia politics, so I'm not naive. Mm-hmm. You think he would have felt a tad bit worried, a tad bit chastened. Instead, he's on the phone threatening city council people, saying, using, some colorful language, saying, if anyone votes for this audit, they're not getting a penny out of here, they're not getting a job out of here. This guy didn't feel chastened at all. He doesn't feel like he needs to answer to anyone. He doesn't feel that there's any actual threat to the kind of behavior that the agency has been shown to do. And Andrew's report is as thorough as it gets. I mean, they're asking for the recommendation letters, and they're asking for the resumes of the other applicants. And the agency, of course, is saying no. But at the same time, it's a little nepotism sprinkled on sexual harassment, on milking the school district of $78 million of overtime and no big contracts, and just there's this Jeopardy board of scandal. So it's not surprising. Sadly.
So as the school district does not get the money, the millions of dollars that it mm-hmm. desperately needs, it's probably fair to use the word desperately. Mm-hmm. Again, employees at the authority are enjoying, I think it was, $700,000 in tuition reimbursements over 5 years. Okay, so let's get back to Ashdale's role as allegedly PPA official number two. He hasn't been identified, or it's suspected that he is PPA official number two.
Yeah, yes.
And again, that story
identifies him.
You're okay.
Not my colleagues reporting.
Andrew's, yep. Yeah. Okay.
Andrew and Jeremy and a number of the other many reporters that have been documenting
this. So this all has to do with attempting to get an audit done on the PPA. And apparently PPA official number two calls up City Councilman Bobby Heenan, who himself is under indictment, and says, at the time he wasn't under indictment, but says, audit. And I guess the audit was quashed, and one of Heenan's friends ended up with window replacements.
Yeah, this is like one of these great little, phone calls that should go down in, Philadelphia civic history. This Ashdale's calling Heenan, again, not feeling at all on the ropes, not feeling chastened amid this avalanche of bad publicity and reporting, and saying and threatening and saying, anyone who dares vote for this, they're not going to get a penny out of here, not getting a job out of there. And then the conversation naturally starts to flow over a series of conversations towards, well, my friend needs windows. Okay, well, we can do that. They can just pay. They don't have to pay the charge. We can just cover the cost, materials, whatever.
And this is all on tape?
So, yeah, it's all in the indictment. So, so I think it was 27 new windows get delivered to Heenan's thing. Ashdale's lawyers, high-priced lawyers, have said, this is all just coincidence. They're friends. They've been friends for a long time. So, again, city council, to what degree, we don't know, is trying to take some action. And the answer to that is, God forbid, anyone who votes for this. And the answer to that seemed to be, well, my good friend needs some new windows.
Yeah. And there was no audit. At the end of the day, there was not from city council. It went
to
the state.
That failed. And I think that was Councilman O's measure.
Okay. So again, at this point, Ashdale hasn't been charged with any wrongdoing. As the investigation continues, what happens next here?
It would be interesting to see, like I've said, we have a little cottage industry at the Inquirer trying to get this guy to talk, to answer a phone call. Yeah. He doesn't feel like that's part of his responsibility on top of this, you know, this multi, you know, gazillion dollar agency. But maybe the feds will have a better luck with that.
Yeah. His job is part time. How much is he pulling in?
He's pulling in $75,000 from the agency. And then he's, you know, he's the head of the Glazers Union, and that's, I think, another like 142 or something like that.
So again, the PPA essentially supposedly serves the city of Philadelphia and the school district, but it is under the auspices of the state.
Yeah, I mean, it's a kind of a convoluted thing, but yes, the state took it over. The ropes are pulled upstate by Prezel. We have a board here. They're not really answerable to anyone. And it's been kind of a long-standing patronage den. I'd like to say in the last 5 years, the Inquirer's reporting has done a really good job of kind of shedding some light, and these audits have done that. But it's what's frustrating, and like I said, it would be funny if it wasn't school kids who are being milked out of this.
Yeah.
It's just maddening. I think
so. Nobody's minding the hen house.
No, I mean Andrew has a great. He ends with a little bit of optimism in the sense that I think Ashdale's bid term ends in 2021, and there's another board member who can be replaced. So maybe by then. But how many more millions of dollars gets wasted by that point? You know, that's a couple years away. That's some type of optimism, if you want to look at it that way.
Well, also, City Controller Rebecca Reinhardt is apparently conducting a performance audit of the parking authority, and I think that's due out, is it the fall?
I think after the summer.
So knowing Reinhardt, is there a reckoning perhaps ahead?
You'd like to think, but again, it's just, you know, when I read Andrew's story, it was like just another chapter in kind of the brazen gall of Ashdale and the agency. So, you would like to think that another hard-hitting audit of, you know, naked corruption or troubling practices would lead to something. But this guy feels it doesn't seem too worried, at least on, you know, the wiretap conversations we'll get out of a federal indictment.
Yeah. Well, despite the note of optimism, I think that Andrew Scheinman was trying to hit, are you feeling any of that moving forward, that there might be a reckoning?
I hope so. Yes, I think the fact that he's, you know, there's going to be a point where he's going to have to, you would think, testify in this federal corruption indictment. And also, I think there is a kind of snowball effect after report after report after report. Yeah. And if you're seeing, you know, some city council leaders and some other people, you know, standing up and trying to fight it.
All right. Mike Newell, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
See you again soon.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Mike Newell is columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Up next, we're going to be talking about two new laws in New Jersey aimed at protecting students who have to take out student loans. Stay with us. This is Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. It's estimated that 44 million Americans owe $1.5 trillion in student loan debt. The story of those lives, or those whose lives are swallowed up by the amount they owe, are all too frequent and heartbreaking. But last week, two new laws were enacted in New Jersey which attempt to break the cycle of destructive debt by requiring public colleges and universities to provide clear information on loans, costs, and debt, and by offering a special ombudsman to help borrowers with complaints. If you'd like to send along questions or comments, here's the email address. Beverly Brown Ruggia is financial justice organizer for New Jersey Citizen Action. She joins us now to help us understand all this more fully. Welcome, Beverly.
Thank you so much for having me.
First, let's get a refresher on the issue and how it can affect everyday lives, especially as the fall semester is fast approaching. In a recent op-ed for NJ Spotlight, Beverly, you write, students are unknowingly signing away their lives by taking out loans to pay for college. Those are some strong words, unknowingly signing away their lives. What are the consequences of overwhelming debt?
The debt that students in this country are facing and in New Jersey amounts to dreams destroyed and lives destroyed. And I mean by that, you know, Americans have traditionally gone to school to move their lives ahead, to pursue careers and jobs that will move them, either secure or move them into middle-class lives. And the student debt, which, as you said, in the country is $1.5 trillion. In New Jersey, last count was about $43.2 billion, means that students are coming out of higher ed with enormous amounts of debt that can take them an entire lifetime to pay back. And what that means is they will not be starting families. They will not be buying homes. They may not even be able to buy cars. Many of them, as we know, are having to live at home. They can't afford the high cost of living, which we know is particularly bad in New Jersey. So the student debt crisis is a symptom of our education system doing the opposite of what it's supposed to do. Rather than providing economic advantages for graduates and people who go back to school to improve their station in their careers, it's actually hurting them. It's actually limiting their ability, in some cases, to get jobs. Debt can mean that you're not able to get jobs. It's limiting their mobility. They can't move across the country to find better paying jobs that might be available elsewhere. So when I say it's people are signing on debt that is ruining their lives, in many cases, that is a fact.
You also point out, Beverly, that lenders won't approve an 18-year-old for a mortgage or small business loan, but will approve a student loan totaling tens of thousands of dollars. Without a whole lot of life experience under your belt, it can be far too easy to fall prey to unscrupulous loan services. Correct.
That's true, and I think sadly it's sort of it's part of the legacy of education in this country. We're told from very little age, young ages, that you must go to college, you must pursue higher ed, or at least technical training to get better, to get better employment opportunities. But as you say, a young person really doesn't have all of the knowledge or experience to weigh in on what a loan of anywhere from $30,000, in some cases $200,000, means in terms of having to pay that loan back. And sadly, families who, rightly so, are so excited to see their children advance through higher ed, are sort of living in the past, assuming that, we sort of think about college in the way it was years ago when it was affordable. And I think that we as a country need to really make sure that families and their children understand exactly what the cost of college is and make sure that they know the terms of these loans that they're taking out and make sure that they're protected from any obstacles in the path in paying those loans back in an efficient and affordable way.
Okay, so let's get to the new laws. Under one of them, signed last week again in New Jersey, public colleges are required to offer students a financial aid shopping sheet dubbed Know Before You Go. And Beverly, as you know, here's what some of what's on it. Mm-hmm. Information about the cost of any one public college, including the grand total for 1 year of attendance, not only tuition, but fees, books, room and board, etc. Also, any grants and scholarships a student might be getting, the net amount a student will owe for 1 year of attendance, and this is important, the median borrowing levels for a college and the percent of students from that college who have defaulted on their loans. What do you think of this shopping sheet?
I think it's a great step in the right direction. It does exactly what we were just talking about. It makes sure that before students enter college, they understand the exact cost. Again, when you get that letter of acceptance to a community college or a four-year college, students and their families are so excited, and they're overwhelmed with the information that they get. And too often they think about loans as awards. And in fact, your package, as we call it, the total package, has different components. There are things that you will not, amounts that you will not have to pay back, and there are amounts that you will have to pay back. And there are costs that people don't often think of, whether it's the books or the lodging. There's a whole lot of, a whole number of pieces to the cost of higher ed that we don't always think about. I'm sure many of your listeners have experienced this. And so the shopping sheet is a huge measure to provide transparency and really change the conversation and make sure that the culture of thinking about higher ed is one in which families and students understand thoroughly what it's going to cost to go to college. And they may decide that perhaps the student is going to go to community college for a couple of years before they finish their four-year education. They may choose a school that has a better package, that in its sum total and net cost is less expensive. But the most important thing is that people understand the debt that they're facing and that they're signing up for, and that's what the shopping sheet allows them to do. It gives them a clear picture of the costs.
I'm thinking there might be one omission here. The shopping sheet applies only to public colleges. I mean, should it have also included perhaps private universities like Rider, Seton Hall, and et cetera?
Definitely, and I think that the fact that the legislature is moving forward on this and so many other measures to make sure that students are understanding and managing their debt better, I think that there will be future policies in place to make sure that every institution's costs are made public.
Yeah. Also, New Jersey will develop a student loan ombudsman's office. How will this help students?
Well, the bill that you're talking about that includes the student, the Office of the Student Loan Ombudsman is really more of a student loan bill of rights. And the core of the bill is the licensing requirement for student loan servicers. And it also includes the creation of the Office of a Student Loan Ombudsman. And it helps students in these ways. First of all, Although federal loans are originated by the U.S. government, they're serviced by private companies and state guarantee agencies that are contracted by the Department of Education. Unfortunately, there's a history of abuse in that industry, and it includes things such as misapplied payments, incorrect billing, not providing students with the best information about how to repay their loans affordably, including not telling students about income-driven repayment plans, moving students into forbearance, which is extremely costly, and not telling them about programs such as public service forgiveness on loans. And what that does is increase debt for students. So the some loan servicers have been guilty of actually making students deepening debt for students.
Hey, and Beverly, let me just jump in. I need to do a station ID here. I'm sorry.
No problem.
You are listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, along with Beverly Brown Ruggia of New Jersey Citizen Action. We are talking about two new laws in New Jersey aimed at protecting students who take out student loans. Beverly, if you've ever looked at a college bill and wondered what some of the fees are for, public colleges are now required, of course, to explain these costs, how they came to the pricing, where the money goes. Do you think that with the light of day, this might lead to a reduction in some fees and even overall cost?
I think so. The crisis is massive. I mean, it's the student debt is only second to mortgages in this country. It's higher than credit card debt. It's impacting every demographic, young people, old people. Everyone is impacted by this crisis. And I think that, yes, the country is going to have to grapple with the root cause, which is the cost of tuition. And as you probably know, federal and state governments have, the federal government and state governments have been divesting from higher education for years. Since the end of the 20th century, they've been shifting the burden of the cost of higher education from public support to individuals. And the cost is untenable. I mean, the average student in New Jersey with student debt, you know, owes more than $30,000 when they come out of college. And so all of these, the current conversations, you've seen it, you know, among candidates for the presidency. This is an issue that is moving to the fore of our minds in this country, and it rightly so. And so I do believe that they're going to have to look at very specifically what you talked about. What are these costs? We're going to have to see legislation that pushes for higher public support of colleges and universities. This is just not something that we can sustain if we're going to be a nation that values high education and wants to be able to compete globally in terms of the employment market.
Let's take a quick look, Beverly, on the campaign, the early campaign on the Democratic side. Of course, presidential candidates Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are talking about canceling all or part of student loan debt. Are there any ideas you've seen that might be able to gain traction?
I think there will be continued debate on whether cancellation of all debt happens. But I do think that looking at certainly forgiving debt after students have paid on their loans, consistently over a number of years, some people believe that canceling the debt after, 15, 20 years is what to do. You know, there obviously are going to be a lot of conversations about how what the cost of for complete forgiveness is. I think it would be good to cancel the debt. But again, the cost of not addressing this this crisis is enormous. I mean, the impact on the economy, the drag on the economy, with depressed purchasing power of millions of people. They're not starting families. They're not investing in their own businesses. They're not buying homes. And so when you begin to weigh those costs, forgiveness starts to look a lot better.
I'd like to get back to something that you brought up a little bit earlier. It's a practice called forbearance. Navient, which is formerly part of Sallie Mae, was sued a couple of years ago for failing to put borrowers into repayment plans that are income-based and instead recommending something called forbearance, in which payments are paused, but the interest keeps accruing. So, Beverly, this sounds like a real financial trap, but if a student feels they have no choice, what are the options?
Well, first of all, the servicers should be moving students into income-driven repayment plans. And there are deferment plans which don't necessarily reduce the costs, but they're not as expensive as moving to forbearance, which has much more, many more fees, and actually, quite frankly, are more profitable for student loan servicing companies, which is probably one of the reasons why they're moving people in that direction rather than income-driven repayment plans. The fact of the matter is the debt itself is overwhelming, but we need to do everything we can to make sure that the debt isn't increased for any individual student because they're not given fair options for repayment. And that's really the problem that's been going on with these student loan servicers.
If it's tough to handle payments, as you mentioned, it can be really tough to get ahead, even with a college degree. Guessing this can make it especially hard for lower income families to move up to the middle class.
Absolutely. The student loan debt crisis has had a greater toll on minorities and women. Historically, access to higher education has been unequal in this country for African Americans and Latino students. First of all, you have the income wealth gap that persists, which means that when students are going to college, they're generally going to have to take out more loans to pay for college. So they come out with more debt at the other end. And that is a tremendous, has a devastating impact on lower income and minority students and their families.
Community college, an option which can be appealing to folks who might not have a whole lot of money at hand. Governor Murphy's community college program has hit a few bumps. As I understand it, Beverly, community colleges in New Jersey offered up to 10,000 students the chance for free tuition this past spring semester. I think the cost was about $20 million. But during budget negotiations this year, when Governor Murphy wanted $58 million to continue the program and expand, the legislature sent him, I think, about $30 million. Do you have, I don't know if you have this information on hand, but do we know where this program stands?
The program is going to move forward, and I know the administration is going to do everything it can to find a way to make it work. The legislature did definitely throw kind of a wrench into the system by actually supporting expansion of the program, but then cutting the funding. I know that this administration has committed, the Department of Education, the Secretary of Higher Education, Zakiya Smith-Ellis, has worked hard to move this program forward. And I know the governor's committed to making it work. I don't want to guess, but I believe that they're going to find a way to make it work.
When we think of those who take out student loans, the picture of a young, fresh-faced college student probably comes to mind for most of us. But I saw a piece recently which profiled students who are older, maybe even baby boomer age, who are also dealing with considerable college debt. Does New Jersey Citizen Action hear from them?
We do. As a boomer myself, or the tail end of the boomer generation, a lot of us went back to school. People went back to school, and a lot of us support our children and grandchildren going to school. And so the number one growing demographic in student debt, unfortunately, is citizens over 60 years old. And that is going to be another tremendous drag on the economy, meaning that people have exhausted their assets in terms of their homes. They may end up losing their homes. They have depleted their savings and their retirement savings. So they are not going to be able to take care of themselves in retirement, and that is going to be a drag on the economy overall.
Well, Beverly Brown-Ruggia, thank you so much for joining us. There are the two new laws in New Jersey which might help mitigate some of this crisis. Beverly is New Jersey Citizen Action's financial justice organizer. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
And up next, Fred Simeone has just been named the number one classic car collector in the world. Stay tuned.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. For the racing car enthusiast, a walk through the Simeone Foundation Automotive Museum in Southwest Philly has got to be a dream experience. It's a collection of racing sports cars, including an American Underslung Traveler from 1909 and a 1956 Mercedes 300 SL Gullwing Coupe or Coupe, depending on which pronunciation you prefer, and dozens more perfectly restored historic cars, all in working order. Fred Simeone's collection has won numerous awards, but now he has captured perhaps the biggest of all. The Classic Car Trust in Liechtenstein has just named Simeone the most significant collector in the world. Simeone is a retired neurosurgeon from Kensington who told his story to Marty on Radio Times a little while back. And we wanted to catch up to him today to say, first of all, congratulations.
Thank you.
And also to get the latest on what's happening over at the museum. So, Fred, welcome back. And what was your reaction when you heard the news?
Well, it was pretty surprising because it is an international recognition. You wonder whether people in Europe know what you're doing, but they obviously did.
You beat out some pretty significant fellow classic car devotees, Ralph Lauren, Sam Walton, many others. Not to belittle their collections, but why do you think yours stands out?
Well, what happened is they assigned the Classic Car Trust is a nonprofit organization, and they assigned a third party that does statistical analysis to look at collections largely from the historical value of the collection, its monetary value, not so important, and what the collection has done for society in terms of education and exposure. They looked at that in depth for 100 of the 200 collections they reviewed, and we had the highest score. So it was a really granular way to look at collections. This is not to say that we're the biggest or has the most attendance. In fact, our attendance is not great.
Not where you want it to be.
But it does show that the collection was curated in a manner that supports their position, which is classic cars are art, and they do have a history which should be preserved.
And these are all in working order.
Yes. Well, that's another reason I think they liked our collection, because unlike most of the others, we demonstrate them in our three-acre track in the back.
So the museum offers a lot of really fun, terrific backstory to these automobiles. If you were to visit the website, for instance, in 1912, a stripped-down national semi-racing roadster, identical to the car in the collection, won the Great Indianapolis 500 race. I think the average speed in the grueling trial was 48.22 miles per hour. Yes. But also, once in motion, the ride, as you write, is powerful and exciting, although the nugatory brakes require one's thinking ahead before attempting to stop.
Yes, these cars do not stop. You have to pull with a handbrake, push with a foot brake, and pray.
Why racing cars for you, Fred?
Well, a racing car, let's take the average collections. We have a limousine or a car that was big and beautiful. But a racing car has the driver. It has the venue that it raced. It has the story of competition. And then, of course, the technological development, which every year got better because of the desire to win. The spirit of competition is our theme, aimed at having young people understand that competition makes everything better.
So which is the earliest era? If we were to go to the museum, how old is the
We have the earliest cars in 1907 Renault, which was William Vanderbilt's car. And he fashioned it after a car that won the first Grand Prix race. It goes all the way up to the mid-1970s. We only collect winning cars, so the winning cars at that point became really too large and too powerful. They became almost just so big that we couldn't take them back on our track. So the answer to your question is 1906 to 1975.
All right. So you are a retired neurosurgeon.
Yes.
So is there some sort of connection between neurosurgery and bringing a car back to its former glory?
People often say that, but it certainly didn't translate to my mechanical skill on cars, which isn't there. But
so you don't work on these yourself?
I do, but not as well as I did with the brains. The real thing is I had to stay in Philadelphia, because when you have an intensive care unit full of people, you don't leave. So my weekends were largely going around looking for cars. And fortunately, in the early days when they weren't appreciated. So that's how we got the collection back in the 70s and 80s.
So when you were searching for cars, how did you go about it, especially in the early days before the internet? Was it word of mouth?
It was largely word of mouth, having dealers look for you, contacting collectors from roster books, reading magazines, and finding out where these cars were at one point in time, and then hoping they're still there.
So what was the farthest flung point to which you traveled to find a car, and what did you find?
One of my favorites was going to Argentina, where we had one blurb in an old magazine that listed the name of the driver of a very, very important car. We found him, now a reprobate hermit, and inside of his shed, covered with pigeon droppings, was this wonderful car.
What was it?
It was a 1929 Alfa Romeo 2900, which of only three were made, and was a race winner. And then we had to sneak it out of Argentina because there was a restriction on exportation of historical treasures.
Well, how did you do that?
Well, we took it apart, and we put it back in the truck. We took it to Uruguay, and then we transported it by boat from Uruguay.
And what was your stomach in knots?
Well, we had hoped, but looking by it like a bunch of parts, that nobody would recognize what it was. Now, if you go online, and I will do a little publicity, www.simeonmuseum.org, SimeonMuseum.org, you'll see what it looks like today. It's a beauty.
Yeah. I would imagine, since, you know, neurosurgery and sneaking a classic car out of Argentina, you must like adrenaline.
Well, that's true. I mean, it was always the risk and the reward. You know, ego's behind everything we do, and I'm certainly no exception. And making a patient better, with your hands is a lot better to me than making better with the medicine and waiting. And that's similar with bringing a car back to life. It has a wonderful feeling when it's done.
So when you come upon this amazing find, as you did when you were in Argentina, and it's covered with pigeon droppings, when you bring it back to the States, what's the process, the restoration process like?
Well, we do as much historical research as we can, find as many contemporary pictures as we can, and go to a great restorer who understands that era, and piece by piece bring it back. Usually there's some pieces missing, which we have to find or make.
And do you try to find the exact piece, you know, perhaps from a different – if there are only three of these cars made in the world, how do you handle that?
Well, sometimes you're really lucky and find the exact piece, and other times you have to make it. In this case, we actually took it back to Italy and raced the car in the Mille Miglia, which is a car that it came in second in 1937. And we redid the race, which is now a rally, but – was a great experience to close that circle.
Fred, have you ever been on the hunt and been disappointed with what you found at the end when you've heard this? There's this treasure that you might be able to.
Sometimes cars are misrepresented. Sometimes they're emphasized by their owners, and then sadly, every once in a while, one gets away from you because another collector was a little bit quicker.
Yeah. So, how do you know that a car is worth collecting?
See, that's really the trick, because in 1960 and 1970, these cars, which are now totally unaffordable, I mean, you cannot buy most of the cars in our collection because of availability or economics. But if you read history in the 60s, before there was really a hobby, before people recognized that automobiles would become historic objects and some of them even icons, that's the time that I managed to buy these out of barns and garages.
So what is your collection worth?
We don't talk about that.
Are you being modest?
No, I gave the collection away, so I don't own it anymore. I gave it to a charity with the hope that it will last forever. And when the economic value became that great, you know, there's no use for accumulating large sums of money.
So you didn't bequeath it to your family?
I left enough a trust fund for my daughter and my granddaughter so that my granddaughter will be educated fully. My daughter works. She's been on this show. And
yes, she has. Christina Simeone.
Interesting academic job. But neither she nor I believe that there is above a certain amount of funds. The rest of it only becomes an impediment rather than – it sounds nice, but it really doesn't change your life. Ask Warren Buffett or Bill Gates. Mm-hmm. They've left limited percentages of their wealth to their children, and that's the way I think it should be.
So of all the cars in your collection, which is your favorite? Or do you have one?
Yes. In the center of the winner's circle is a car on a pedestal called an Alfa Romeo 2900B, similar to the one we talked about, but different. It won the Mille Miglia race, and it has, as there's a statement, the more girls will understand than men, it checks all the boxes, and this one checks all the boxes for style, design, performance, history, and drop-dead beauty.
And have you driven it?
I took it to Italy three times to race, yes.
Oh, okay. So you raced it yourself.
Well, it's a rally and it's a race. But you race for a while and you stop for a little Meloni, Prosciutto, Vino, and then you race a little more and you have some formaggio. But we do, when we're in the streets of Italy, we go pretty fast.
So when you are behind the wheel, what's that experience like?
It's a Walter Mitty ego, I'm Tazio Nuvolari kind of
feeling. Oh, it sounds like fun.
It's fun.
So when you were a young man, what sparked you to start doing this?
I think my biography is my dad. He was a general practitioner, son of immigrants. All he wanted to do was have his little office in Kensington and practice.
So you were from Kensington?
Yes. Yeah. And dad worked his way through medical school fixing cars. So by the time I was five, I really understood certain things about the beauty, the importance, the significance, and the reverence of cars. And that carried me through the rest of my life.
So, again, this recognition from the Classic Car Trust in Liechtenstein, you are the most relevant collector, the most significant collector in the world.
In the world, yes.
In the world. I mean, so what does this mean for your collection?
Well, hopefully, at least in Philadelphia, I hope people will recognize that it's still there. It's not in the best location because
it's not far from Philly International
Airport. It's not near, right? It's near the airport, but that allows us to have this track where we demonstrate them, which we couldn't do in Center City. I just hope that it will survive when I'm not here. The collection is given to a charity, and the charity has a bit of an endowment. We have had no philanthropy, but I think that if the city realizes something important, they'll start to recognize, and even if not, the cars are preserved for future. There will always be historians and students who want to see the very best of the best.
So the Simeone Foundation not only offers this this automotive museum, but you're getting young people involved. You've got a summer camp.
It's on right now, yes.
Which is happening, yep. And I love this. It's called a STEAM education, kind of a play off of STEM, which is science, technology, engineering, and math. And where does the A come from?
The academics actually added that. It's art.
Okay.
And that was added by the people who study this. Yes.
So what is the art?
Well, oh, my God.
All right. So we've got
look on the website. www.simeonemuseum.org. Their cars are just beautiful. We had a lady yesterday who said, looked at a Jaguar and said, if this were a refrigerator, it would be beautiful. You don't have to know about cars to come and see how great looking they are and inspiring, and then think about what that meant in terms of design and speed.
So when people come to look at the cars, and racing day or riding day or whatever you called it is probably one of the funnest days to
attend. Yes, it is. There are Saturdays, alternate Saturdays, and you can find that online.
How fast do they go?
Not very fast. Because
do you take all of them out?
We take certain ones. Like we did Bastille Day last Saturday, and we took out the French cars. So there's usually four or five, and the audience is forced to listen to a historical discussion about 20 minutes before they get to see them running.
They're forced to listen to
Yes, yeah. Well, because what's the importance of a historical automobile if you don't know the history?
Yeah. And do you do that yourself? Do you do the presentation?
Yeah, that's the fun part.
Yeah. And well, tell us a little bit about what's in your presentation.
Well, we talked about how the French Resistance fought against the Germans. And believe it or not, the heroes in the French Resistance were sometimes race car drivers. And they secretly fought the Germans through their contacts. And we have four cars that were actually owned or raced by these great saboteurs.
Really? Mm-hmm. Which ones?
Talbot Lago, Peugeot, Darma, the Bugatti that won Le Mans in 1937, one of our halo cars. And then another French car called the Delahaye, which was owned by Pierre Louis Dreyfus, Louis Dreyfus's grandpa.
Really?
He was a great race driver, yes.
Oh, wow. That's fascinating. So, Fred Simeone, are you on the hunt? Do you have anything in mind out there in the world that you are eyeing right now?
Well, sadly, but yes, maybe happily as well, the value of the cars which belong in the collection, the winners, the icons, are beyond my economic ability. They weren't in the 60s and 70s when I bought them,
right. But
now they are. So,
but even in pieces someplace.
Yeah, we've had some very nice donations. The Renault I talked about was donated by a family who owned it since 1920, and we've had other cars donated if they fit. But I think we've told the story of the sports racing car with the 70 cars we have there now. So if magically something great comes along, it may find its way. But we're not actively looking.
Well, Fred Simeone, thank you so much for joining us once again. And once again, congratulations.
Thanks for having me. It was great.
Fred has been named by the Classic Car Trust in Liechtenstein as the most significant collector in the world. And again, his museum is not too far from the airport, not hard to get to.
www.simeonemuseum.org.
All right. And as always, if you, as a listener, get the chance to check us out here at Radio Times on social media, you'll also find some terrific podcasts here. Our engineer today has been Charlie Kyer. Our producer is Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Great to have you along for the Radio Times Regional Roundup.